Hi, John.
Hi, Carrie.
Welcome to Blogging Heads. I'm Carrie Howley, an editor at Reason Magazine.
And I'm John Cassiopo from the University of Chicago.
And we're here to discuss John's book, Loneliness, which is about the physiology and impact of loneliness in our lives. John, are you in Chicago right now?
I am. I'm sitting in my office.
I'm just wondering what the temperature is, because this is actually, I'm in Iowa, just south of you, and this is the coldest day of my life. It's negative 41 degrees with wind chill.
It's warmer here. It's only about minus 30 with wind chill when I came in this.
Oh, there you go. So that sounds comfortable. So I wanted to talk about one of the most interesting issues in loneliness is the way in which you go about measuring loneliness in your subjects. You mentioned that in the book that social interaction, the frequency of social interaction, isn't what predicts the feeling of social isolation. So how is it that you go about determining whether a person really is lonely?
We use a survey instrument called the UCLA Loneliness Scale. It's 20 items, and the question of do you feel lonely never appears in the scale. It's items such as are there others to whom you can talk, in whom you can confide? Do you feel alone is one of the items. So they're more about how you feel about those around you than asking you to self-label as a lonely person.
Okay. And how then do you go about determining whether these reported effects, which you aggregate as loneliness, are what's causing the physiological effects that you mention in the book?
That's a very good question. There's two methods we use. One is experimental manipulations, where we randomly assign people to a condition in which loneliness is induced or in which loneliness is not induced. That's the best way of making sure there are not other factors that are operating. The problem with that is you don't want to leave people in lonely states over long periods of time to see if there might be deleterious physiological effects, because you're doing harm to them. So the other way we do it is we measure loneliness and a host of other factors: depressive symptomatology, perceived stress, actual stress, how many people they're with, felt hostility, a number of factors like that. We measure those repeatedly over years. And then we look for natural variations in, say, loneliness, and we look at the variations in the related variables, including the physiology, to see, can loneliness predict changes in the physiology? Is it related to the physiology, independent of what could be explained by these other variables? That's called cross-like panel longitudinal analyses.
Okay. And I guess we've skipped ahead a bit here. I should have asked, what are some of those physiological effects? Because part of what you're explaining in this book is that loneliness makes you sick, and not just because there's not someone around when you're old to take care of you and make sure you take your medicine, that there are actual physical manifestations, physiological manifestations of this psychological state.
Right. In fact, it was 1988, there was an article published in Science showing epidemiologically that social isolation predicted illness and death earlier. And the expectation from that paper was that it's the presence of other people to help you that determines whether you stay healthy, whether somebody's making that doctor's appointment for you. We read that work and was aware that studies of other animals, non-human animals that are social species, in which you isolate one of those animals too die earlier. And so that made us think.
So then it's not about the quality of health care being provided by the other animals.
It's not exclusively about the health care or the fact that they may have someone making doctor's appointments for them, because fruit flies, bees, pigs, mice don't have that luxury. And that's what really led us to look for what are the physiological consequences of isolation and loneliness. We started with isolation and found humans are very conceptual. We're very symbolic. And you can be in a crowd and feel isolated, and you can be writing in your office alone and feel highly connected to the audience to whom you're writing. And so it's really the perceived isolation that we found to be the more important factor. And of course, perceived isolation has been defined in the field for a long time as loneliness. So that's how we got to the study of loneliness. The physiological effects, we found a number of them. One of these quick effects we find is increased vascular resistance. This is greater resistance to blood flow throughout your body. And that's a common physiological response one sees when an individual is put in a threatening situation. The unique thing about our finding is that people who feel lonely remain in that physiological threat position. And they may not even be aware of it, but basically loneliness places the brain on high alert for possible social threats, and so they maintain this increased vascular resistance.
So is this like a fight or flight response?
The fight-or-flight response that Walter Cannon talked about was slightly different. He talked about, for instance, increased catecholamines and a diffuse sympathetic discharge. And our research has not found loneliness to be related to the catecholamines, this particular stress system, nor to as widespread an effect as Walter Cannon talked about. But rather, it's relatively specific. It's vascular resistance. Subsequently, that leads to increased blood pressure. We find higher morning levels of adrenocorticotropic hormone. This is a precursor to cortisol, a very powerful steroidal stress hormone in the body. We find larger morning rises in lonely than non-lonely individuals, and in the same individuals if they felt lonely the night before than if they didn't feel lonely the night before. The cortisol affects the immune system, and of course loneliness affects immunity all the way down to gene transcription inside immune cells.
Okay, so that all sounds very dangerous over the long term. Is this something that would affect, I mean, people move throughout their lives, so if someone were to relocate and be lonely for 6 months, is that something that they need to be worried about, or are these effects over a more long-term period of time?
That's a very good question. It really depends on which variable we're talking about. So the vascular resistance would go up and would probably remain higher for that six-month period. We also find that lonely individuals sleep less efficiently. They sleep as many hours, but they show more what are called micro-awakenings. So they wake up more fatigued, and we find that in our longitudinal analyses, which means the same individual, if they feel lonely on a day, that night they're likely to show less efficient sleep than when they don't feel lonely. Those kinds of effects would be shown by the person who moved and was lonely for 6 months. The increased blood pressure we find takes years, not minutes, hours, days, or even months. That takes about a 3 to 5 year window for the effects on blood pressure to be seen. And even then, we find it in older adults, not younger adults, because their homeostatic mechanisms are still young and resilient.
Okay. And there are also these psychological effects. I mean, when we become lonely, our emotional responses seem, at least as you report in the book, to be quite self-defeating. We also become hostile. Is that right?
Correct.
And I guess the question I have is, it seems quite obvious that the feeling of loneliness would be adaptive, in that being away from the pack is going to be dangerous to primitive humans. So I'm wondering why we would have evolved to have all these negative responses emotionally that make it actually more difficult for us to escape from the feeling of loneliness.
Well, there's a couple different answers to that I'll give you. One is that if you think about other aversive but adaptive responses, physical pain, hunger, thirst, all of those are aversive signals that motivate us to correct an important biological need on the part of the organism. If we didn't have pain, we might think we would celebrate a more joyous life, but in fact it's a very dangerous life, because we don't know when we're doing injury to our own body. Loneliness has evolved as that same kind of aversive signal to motivate us to reconnect. And as you say, in evolutionary times and in developmental times, when we're young, we require on others. We require the presence for our own survival and to prosper. So it motivates us to attend to that aspect of our environment when we start to show a deficiency. Just like hunger, if you don't actually attend to that signal, then grave damage can actually occur to the body, and we see the same thing with loneliness. Now, the psychological consequences, what we have found is that loneliness increases the likelihood people will become more depressed over a year. And that's a very robust effect. We now know that it's loneliness that's leading to increased depression. We don't find the reverse direction in anything nearly as strong a force. And so one could have...
What do you mean? Meaning that depression doesn't cause increased loneliness?
Right. It's a much, much weaker effect. Loneliness has a very strong effect on subsequent depression. That's even controlling for how depressed you are today. How depressed you are today, though, doesn't predict very well how lonely you might be a year from now after I've taken out how much of that loneliness I can predict from today's feelings of loneliness. And so the influence seems to be from loneliness to depression. And one could reasonably ask as you have, why would we evolve to have depression follow loneliness? And there's actually a good evolutionary reason for that. If you think in those historic times, if you're rejected from a group, the tendency will be to want to go back to that particular group. But that can be dangerous. If you've been thrown out of that group, there's a real incentive to not try to force your way back into it, because they can get frustrated by kicking you out and then do more damage to you. So if you think about depression or sadness, it's characterized in part by a lethargy, so you're not as likely to be animated and go back into the group. But it's also characterized by social signaling. You have this sad expression, you cry, you adopt a posture that clearly signals you want and need attention, attention of someone else. And so if there's anyone in that context that is willing to connect with you, that's really a nonverbal cry to garner their attention. And so that's an adaptive combination when you think about it.
One of the more concerning emotional effects you mentioned in the book, from my perspective, was that people who are lonely actually become more likely to conform to prevailing opinion. Would it be fair to conclude that the expression of individualism is easier within a social network?
Yes, if you feel connected to the others around you, you actually feel greater latitude to differ in your opinion. Sometimes it's called idiosyncrasy credit. If you already are valued by a group or feel valued by a group, you're allowed to diverge from group norms a little more than if you haven't yet achieved that status or recognition within the group.
That's really interesting. What are the other psychological effects? So how else does a lonely person react to his or her environment in a different way than a socially connected person does?
One of the findings in our research is that lonely individuals are poor at self-control, at executive functioning. We used what's called the dichotic listening task and found lonely and non-lonely individuals perform similarly in this kind of very peculiar acoustic task when they didn't have to exert self-control. But when they had to exert self-control to listen to the particular subtle acoustic cues that were required to perform the task, lonely individuals did much more poorly than non-lonely individuals. Roy Baumeister at Florida State University has done related research since that time where he's randomly assigned people to what they believe to be a future in which they're going to live an isolated life. They have friends now, but they're going to lose them. That is a future facing loneliness, or a future facing some other horrible consequence, but it's orthopedic. They're going to have lots of accidents and bone problems. Both of these are unpleasant futures, but only the future of loneliness had an effect of compromising their ability to do complex problem solving and their ability to exert self-control and self-regulation. If you think about what's going on in that those studies, well, loneliness is a horrible, miserable feeling. And one way to get some relief is to not control yourself in the same fashion. So there's alcohol, there's a cigarette, there's sugars, there's a cake. why not imbibe? Give me a little bit of a reward feeling in this short term, and I'm feeling so horrible that'll make things better. And that seems to be, in fact, one of the reasons loneliness impairs executive functioning is we have an absence of other rewards, and so people are selecting short-term rewards that have long-term costs. And so, indeed, we find lonely individuals eat higher fat and sugar diets, and they are less likely to exercise than non-lonely older adults.
Can those effects be causally attributed? I mean, isn't it possible that people are eating more simply because they don't feel that they have anyone to look good for, or that they're exercising less simply because they don't anticipate being part of a social group?
That's absolutely possible, except in Roy's studies, he has randomly assigned people to the lonely and non-lonely groups. And he then, in one of his studies, he placed something that was delicious, chocolate chip cookies, for instance, on the table, and they could eat as many as they wished. But these were clearly cookies that were bad for your health. They had a healthy alternative in one of the studies, but they were able to select, and indeed the lonely individuals ate more of the delicious but not very good for you cookies than the non-lonely individuals. And so from studies like that, we're better able to determine it's the self-regulation that's being impaired by loneliness rather than the other way around. In our research on exercise behavior, we measured self-regulation as well, and in fact we found the impaired self-regulation was causing the decreased exercise behavior in our lonely individuals.
My favorite sort of cocktail party fact in the book is this idea that lonely people are more apt to anthropomorphize the world around them. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. We are such social creatures. One of the things we have found is that people create sociality. They create connections when they can't find them in their social world. So we find, for instance, that lonely individuals are more likely to anthropomorphize, see humanity and non-human entities, and we've studied a variety. So I'll give you an example study. My screensaver are photos from the Hubble telescope, and a graduate student by the name of Adam Waits and I printed those out, and he took them downtown in Chicago and walked around with these photographs and showed them to people downtown and asked them to rate how much did this celestial body have free will. To what extent was it animated? And what we then looked at was how lonely did the individuals feel. We have a three-item scale that we use, and we related their feelings of loneliness to how much they anthropomorphize these celestial bodies, and how much did loneliness relate to just any kind of dispositional attribution that was not anthropomorphic, like that it has, as that it's animated. And what we found was that loneliness predicted their tendency to make anthropomorphic attributions. We then came back to the lab and manipulated experimentally whether people felt lonely or non-lonely, and again found it's the those who were randomly assigned to the loneliness condition were more likely to anthropomorphize celestial bodies, gadgets, pets, and other animals. And when asked about their belief in God, those who are in the loneliness condition express stronger beliefs in God as well.
And the connection you make in the book, which I found particularly interesting, is that people report feeling closer to God when they're alone, and perhaps this is because it's easier to imagine human features within the natural world when we're not surrounded by other people.
That's right. And, you know, God is there for your connecting to, if you will, and so if you feel lonely, then you know you draw closer to a supernatural being or something like God, as a way of connecting inferentially over when you feel connected to others around you.
You know, this book is so unrelentingly anti-loneliness. I'm wondering, you know, there is a romanticism around solitude and space apart, and you know, is there any evidence that loneliness and something like creativity might be linked, or can you say anything good about the state of being alone?
Well, first of all, I have become a fan and defender of loneliness. When we began our research, loneliness was viewed as having no redeeming features and little different than, you know, neuroticism or depression. We found all of that to be incorrect. I mean, I'm a fan of pain, not because I think we should experience it, but if we didn't have a pain system, we would perish. So, you know, it's nice to know its adaptive features and the purpose that it evolved to serve so that we can better respond appropriately to it. You know, the purpose of pain is to make it stop, but it's a good thing that we have it. Loneliness gives us our humanity. I mean, if we didn't have that motivation to connect to other people, then we would be a much less interesting and altruistic or cooperative species. So I see a real virtue, if you will, in having the capacity to feel loneliness. That doesn't mean I think loneliness is a state we should remain in, and that speaks to your question. But I would like to separate loneliness from being alone. Many creative states are solitary states, as I suggested earlier. Writing is a very solitary activity. Composing music, art, often very solitary acts. But at least when I write, I'm writing with colleagues with whom I've worked in my head and an audience to whom I'm writing in my head. So although it's a solitary act, it's not a lonely act whatsoever. And so I see a real difference between the solitude, the blissful solitude of being alone as I work on a project versus the misery of loneliness when I feel disconnected from others, whether or not I'm around other people.
I think that your book operates on two levels. There's this wonderful, dense study of loneliness on the individual level, its physiological effects and causes and evolutionary purposes, but there's also quite a bit of concern about where we're going as a society, that it's become more difficult in American society to form connections. And I'm wondering, have there been sort of cross-cultural studies, the way we can, at our peril, but we can compare, for instance, happiness studies across different cultures? Is there something comparable for loneliness so we can see what kind of social structure produces social connection?
Yes, that's a very good question. They have been done. And some of the results often surprise people at first. I mean, we know, for instance, that in collectivist cultures, China versus the U.S., Italy versus Norway, the more collectivist cultures, the levels of loneliness, in fact, are higher. Now, that might sound contradictory, but it actually isn't. And I'll do an example within the United States, and I think it'll make more sense. And then I'll give you the theoretical reason why. People find Christmas or Thanksgiving or Hanukkah, those holiday periods that are normatively characterized by family and friends getting together, people find those to be among the loneliest times of year. Now, the reason, of course, is because they may feel disconnected from others, and at those times of year, the norm, the cultural norm, is for everybody to feel connected and warm.
When you say people feel, you mean on average everyone feels more lonely? Because my interpretation of that, I mean, you always hear that people who are alone feel more lonely at Christmas. Are you saying people who feel connected feel more lonely at Christmas?
No. Thank you for the question. I do not mean that. I mean, most people don't feel lonely. I mean, lonely is the accepted state, very much like most people are not in pain at any point in time. So most people are not in a lonely state. It's only about 20-25% at any point in time who kind of feel the intense misery of loneliness. Now, that's not a trivial number, but it's not the majority of the people. The normal state is to feel non-lonely. So those who feel lonely, that feeling is exacerbated, is amplified during these holiday periods. So thank you for the clarification. Now, the reason it's exaggerated during those holiday periods is because during normal days, it's not as obvious that they are different than everybody else in their feelings of loneliness. During Christmas or Thanksgiving or other holidays, because the norm is to feel connected and close, when you don't feel that way, the existential isolation is exaggerated. For that same reason, cultures like Italy or China where it's the cultural norm to feel connected to others, to be connected to others, to feel in a very warm embrace of your friends and family. To find yourself not that way is existentially more isolating, more painful than in cultures where that's not the norm. And so that's the reason for the cross-cultural differences that we see.
I wonder if it's not also sort of my experiences, and I lived in Southeast Asia for a bit, and in a really family-oriented culture, there are perhaps less norms for connecting to strangers. So if I am to migrate and leave my family, I have less guidance for how to connect with these strange people who aren't part of my social network. It seems like that could be partly responsible for explaining the effect as well.
That may be contributing, absolutely.
So moving beyond the cross-cultural evidence, is there evidence that Americans are more lonely than they used to be?
Yes. There was a sociological study published around 1985 that asked the question, how many confidants do you have? And the most frequent response was three. That question was repeated in 2004, and the most frequent response was zero. If you look at just physical residential isolation, the number of people living alone has increased dramatically over the last 60 years. And so there's evidence that we are living more isolated lives. If you look at reported loneliness, there are not the same kind of data available at a national level. Mm-hmm. But we know, for instance, that whether you have confidence or not is a very strong predictor of how lonely you feel. So I see that sociological data as speaking in part to your question. What little evidence we do have from broad studies done 20, 30 years ago versus now, we see a crawling up of the percentage of people. It's moved from around 20% to closer than, for instance, 25% now who are complaining about loneliness at both intense levels and in terms of frequency, repeatedly throughout a week.
My impression was that some of this evidence, and correct me if I'm wrong, is quite controversial in that, say, the GSS in 1985 would ask questions like, have you discussed anything important with someone in the last 6 months? And the definition of something important turns out to be so highly variable that it's hard to compile statistics. So, for instance, someone might say, oh, well, I have nothing important to talk about, but I'm not lonely. I talk to people all the time. I mean, is this a clear trend, or are we kind of in the realm of theory and hypothesizing?
Yeah, your point's well taken. The that particular study points to one source of evidence that we have increased isolation. The demographic data are actually very dramatic in terms of the number of people living alone or living in smaller families, living waiting longer to get married or undergoing divorce. So we have a much larger number of individuals living in isolated settings. And I suggested that although I'm not overwhelmed by the data on loneliness simply because it's not really available, what little mm-hmm. is available makes it look like we've increased perhaps 15-20% in terms of the number of people who report frequently feeling lonely.
Okay. I mean, the demographic data, living alone, how highly does that predict being lonely? I mean, we were just talking about collectivist cultures where you probably have many, many more people living under the same roof, but all of those people feel more socially isolated in some sense.
Right. No, we've looked at how well these things predict, and they are significant predictors, and your suggestion's well taken. Living an isolated life, that is, living alone, does not necessarily mean by any stretch that one's going to feel lonely. That's why I say you look at these different sources of data, and together they start to paint a more convincing picture that loneliness has increased over the last 20, 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm. And part of the reason, I guess, I find that so surprising is that rootedness has increased. I mean, Americans move less than they ever have in American history, apparently. Partly because they're less economically marginalized, they're not moving locally. But we have become... It's more likely that you will stay in the same community, and yet you're suggesting that even though we're staying in the same places, we're just not forming the same kind of connections.
Part of that's just the stress and time demands on individuals today. People are working longer hours. They're working harder than 30 years ago. And, you know, an individual may be married, have family, have friends, but not really have the opportunity to enjoy kind of quality time, to sit on the porch and talk to the neighbors that they enjoy next door. And so factors like that are helping to mitigate the increased stability that you're talking about. But indeed, one of the predictors of feelings of loneliness that we find is the number of times people have moved over the last 10 years. So this increased social stability is helping to mitigate what otherwise would be a larger increase in feelings of loneliness.
I see. What effect does the internet have? I think a lot of theorists who talk about social isolation tend to be kind of dismissive of connections made over the internet. They're seen as shallow or what have you, even though they do, you know, facilitate face-to-face meetings, obviously. But it's clear that communication is just drastically cheaper than it once was, and it's cheaper to fly to see someone as well. It's cheaper if you're an immigrant to keep in touch with your family. Do you think that the internet is also having a mitigating effect, or are PCs part of the problem?
It's a great question, and the answer is not neither. The internet has been shown to both increase and decrease feelings of loneliness. So it really depends how the internet's being used. If the internet is used to replace face-to-face contacts, and those new contacts are of not higher quality, and that actually is more common than people might think. For instance, if I'm spending all my time, rather than with my students or with my friends, instead I'm garnering 4,000 friends on Facebook, but I don't actually interact or talk very much with my friends on Facebook, I don't know any of them deeply, then that actually promotes loneliness. It doesn't decrease loneliness. On the other hand, if I'm using the net because otherwise I would not be able to get out of my house, I have a disability, I have a stigma, and by having the internet, I'm able to connect with people similar to myself, it decreases loneliness. If I'm using the internet to meet new friends or to stay in contact with my old friends and coordinate meetings so that we can actually get together, it decreases loneliness. So it really depends whether it's being used as a substitute or whether it's being used to promote interactions you otherwise would not have.
So what are the, given how deleterious loneliness is, and given how just a little social interaction is so valuable in the long term, what are things lonely individuals can do to sort of reach out?
Right. There's a handful of things. We've used an acronym in the book called EASE, E-A-S-E, Ease Your Way Into Social Connection. One of the things I will preface going through that acronym with is we don't simply say be positive toward everyone because not everyone's trustworthy. And lonely individuals who deeply want to connect with other people can make poor judgments and fall into scams. And so it's not, you know, I'll go through this, but it's not about just being nice and positive about everyone. It's being more discriminating and more realistic. So the first E stands for extend yourself. Lonely individuals, people who have felt lonely over a chronic period, start to develop this expectation that others are going to be harmful or damaging to them. They've had bad experiences in the past. And it's not uncommon to find that they've just given up. It's better not to have any interaction than to have the interactions that lead to the pain of rejection yet again. Much of the cognitive consequences of loneliness come from not wanting to feel that pain, expecting to be rejected or hurt by another individual. And so people engage in self-protective behavior. That is, they do things to protect themselves, but that ends up
reinforcing the loneliness.
Right. And so it's understandable why at some point an individual might say, well, I'm just going to keep to myself, or, you know, keep to my pet, or to my religion, or to my internet friends, and stay at a distance. And although that's understandable, one doesn't overcome loneliness, through that means. So we say extend yourself, but extend yourself in a safe fashion. Realizing that loneliness puts your brain on high alert. You're not necessarily aware of this, but your brain is on high alert. Going back to evolutionary times, it's watching for possible social dangers. That means you're going to walk in to circumstances where you may overinterpret the negativity or the distrustfulness of another individual. So if you put yourself in a situation where you like the activity anyway, and you're doing voluntary service, if you like dogs, volunteer at a vet or at a zoo. If you like to read, perhaps volunteer at a school or in a library, that kind of activity. What you find is you're reaching out to other people is appropriate by context. That is, you're a volunteer helping. And the people who you're helping are going to be grateful. And so you get a lot of positive feedback from your reaching out. And so you start to learn from that kind of interaction that, you know, connecting with other people, I'm not asking anything from them. You know, it's really just that interaction of reaching out and connecting has a strong rewarding value to you, even if there's not a continuation of that relationship. And so you get a little more comfortable in that context of extending yourself, of reaching out. The A in EASE stands for develop an action plan. Being connected with others isn't about being a superhero. It's about being human. We are inherently social creatures. We're obligatorily gregarious. We know how to do this, right? We sometimes overthink it, and if I'm expecting things to go badly or I'm worried about you harming me, that's introducing expectations, bringing into our relationship features that are not going to be productive. If I get out of my own head, right, and I start thinking about us rather than me in interaction with you, that whole context starts to change. My whole thoughts about it start to change. Now, that's not a simple transition, but if you develop an action plan and realize I don't have to be superhuman, I just have to be human. Imagine a cocktail party. Perhaps you and I meet at a cocktail party, or you meet someone at a cocktail party. A lonely individual's tendency will be to think about themselves. Oh, here I am, and you know, how is this going? A person who's not feeling lonely has a slightly different perspective. They think about you and about how interesting the interaction is, what you're telling me, how I'm learning, how well prepared, how interesting the questions are, and how appreciative for the opportunity to speak together. And that view as a collective is what helps support a high-quality interaction. So it's to develop an action plan. It doesn't mean doing everything. It means just being human, but not bringing in these artificial expectations. The S is selection. Not everybody's trustworthy, I alluded to, and what it means to have a high-quality relationship is that you feel you're getting more out of the relationship than you're putting into it, and so does the other person. So it's not enough to have a high-quality relationship if I think I'm getting a lot out of what I'm putting in, and the other person feels like they're carrying the relationship, right? When you go into a grocery store, you give them money, they give you food. That's an equal trade. When you deal with a child, you may be doing more than you're getting back from the child. Good marriages, you feel like you're actually getting a lot more than you're materially or emotionally putting into the relationship, and so does your spouse. Good friends, high-quality relationships are of that kind. They can even be work relationships. You have this team, and you put this group of people together, and magic happens at workplace, right?
Sure. This selection subject, it also puts me in mind of bad marriages. I mean, I believe a lot of the happiness data says that you're less happy in a bad marriage than in no marriage at all, even though being in a marriage at all predicts happiness almost better than anything else. Is that all the effect of loneliness? I mean, are people in bad marriages more lonely than people who are not married?
Yes, and in fact, marriage has a health beneficial effect, but when you put in loneliness, that effect disappears. So being in a marriage makes you less lonely, but being in a marriage that doesn't, if you're lonely in your marriage, you serve little, if any, health benefit from that marriage.
Okay.
Now, how do you...
Sorry to derail you there.
Yeah, no, the selection, what are the predictors of these high-quality relationships? Well, it turns out it's similar attitudes, similar beliefs, similar values, similar interests and activities. So that means if I like, let's say I'm a Democrat or Republican, I like reading or athletics, I should go to places, I should find individuals who share those interests, who share those values, who share those attitudes and beliefs, because over time, this idea of having a synergy, of having a high-quality relationship, is just more likely, and it's more likely to be maintained. Now, in fact, we often use superficial features. Are they rich? Are they physically attractive? Are they high status? To identify who we are likely to have a great relationship with. And those turn out to be poor predictors. They're just, not that they're negatively predicting, they're just irrelevant. It's really similarity that predicts the likelihood of long-term, high-quality relationships. And so one would want to be attentive to that because of the last letter in this acronym, and that's E for expect the best. If you've selected well and you can trust the individual, there is this, if you will, emergence of reward on both your part from the interaction, then you have to realize that people are going to do things that are hurtful. And that doesn't mean they're bad people or that they would do that intentionally in a continuing fashion. You're going to do that as well. So that if you expect the best, you forgive and go on with the relationship. Good marriages and bad marriages have fights as part of that marriage. The difference isn't the presence or absence of a fight, it's what happens afterwards. In a good marriage, the individuals in the marriage do things to bring each other closer together again. They forgive, they apologize, they change their ways so that the union is reinforced. In bad marriages, they make the attribution that, oh, this is just going to get worse. This is you're a bad person, rather than that was a bad act. And, in fact, that leads to a further disconnection between the two in that marriage.
We mentioned earlier that loneliness is just, it's a natural part of life. Are there certain age groups that are more at risk? Are there times in the average life when one ought to expect to feel lonely for a while? What are the predictors of short-term loneliness in for the average lifespan?
Yes, there are episodes, there are life events, and there's age. If you look at age per se, one of the surprising findings is loneliness doesn't go up dramatically until late in life. So many people, myself when I started this work included, thought that loneliness was higher in late middle age and older adults than in young adults, and that's not the case. It's in fact fairly flat, like I said, until late life, and at that point you're starting to lose friends and family, and it's so painful. You might reconnect once, and then that can be painful, and so you just don't want to go through the pain of losing people anymore, and so you stay disconnected, and loneliness really rises quite dramatically at that point in life. There are life events, though. For instance, when kids go off to college, they feel that there's a big increase in loneliness for a few weeks in that cohort, and there's often a little bit of a blip at home as well, as all of a sudden a child who had been perhaps viewed as a nuisance at the dinner table for the past 18 years no longer was there, and so there can be a bit of a hole in a family for a period as you transition to a different kind of family organization. And we mentioned earlier, you brought up the point of moving. Moving not within a neighborhood, but moving long distances is a way of rupturing connections, and that life event, too, can increase feelings of isolation and loneliness.
Is there a time period by which you distinguish sort of short-term normal loneliness and what you might call chronic loneliness?
Yes. In part, it depends. That this can be an arbitrary decision. If you lose a spouse, though, it is abnormal to not feel miserable. To feel, you know, it would be unusual for you not to feel lonely and saddened by that. And that period typically lasts about 18 months. After that, people tend to start putting their lives back together. Loneliness goes down. Depressive symptoms start to go back down. That would be a normal sequence. Now, bereavement is one of the most dramatic causes of loneliness that exist. So I'm giving you an extreme case.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that if you don't feel loneliness or sad at all following a spouse's death, but you had felt close to the spouse, that's actually diagnostic of subsequent problems. It's quite natural to have these feelings, and in very severe cases, it can take on the order of months, and that's still quite normal. On the other hand, if you move and you're feeling lonely, the idea is these should be motives to take the time to reconnect, find individuals in your new community who share interests, activities, and start to form new friends.
Well, thank you so much, John, for that 45 minutes of companionship. Good luck with the book, and thanks for coming on Blogging Heads.
Thank you very much.